Tonight I thought I'd talk a bit about sense pleasures and the Buddhist attitude, the Buddha's teachings about sense pleasures. It's quite an important topic in Buddhism, but one which, you hear different things about the Buddha's ideas on sense pleasures. You may have heard Buddhism referred to as the middle way. It's, in his very first teaching, the Buddha said, I found a middle way. And it was specifically in terms of the attitude to sense pleasures that that he meant. He said there are these two extremes, the overindulgence in sense pleasures, on the one hand, and the other extreme is to completely deny any pleasures of the senses. And the Buddha, having tried both these extremes, he said that he'd found a middle way, and the middle way produced happiness, peace, and enlightenment. So so just to be clear what we mean by sense pleasures, we're talking about sense pleasures in particular because, firstly, and it's an important point, that not all pleasures are sense pleasures, sensual pleasures. So we're talking here about the pleasure that comes through any of the five ordinary senses we talk about. So pleasant tastes, pleasant sights, pleasant feelings in the body, pleasant sounds, music, you know, the pleasure of music, the pleasure of watching the sunset, good food, all of these things are sense pleasures. So the usual, unthinking attitude to them, and also even when people think about sense pleasures, but don't think very deeply about it, what one notices, even as a child, is that when I have pleasant things, like if I eat an ice cream, I feel good. You know, that's nice. So a child will typically think, so if I have 100 ice creams, I'll feel even 100 times as good. And they'll, without realizing that if you eat 100 ice creams, you tend to feel pretty bad. But generally speaking, pleasant sights, sounds, and tastes, and so forth, they make us happy. So the assumption is that if I have more of this, then I'll be happier still. And there's other things which are unpleasant. So if you have painful feelings, you go to the dentist and have your teeth drilled and things, these things hurt. Think, okay, that wasn't so good. So the basic strategy that people adopt is, if I increase the pleasant experiences in my life, have more of them, and minimize or even ideally eradicate the unpleasant experiences, then basically I'll be happier. And all the rest of the things, because life is divided into those things which give us pleasant feelings, things which give us unpleasant feelings, and majority, which are just kind of neutral and bland, and kind of boring, nothing much at all. So the basic attitude is more of the fun, less of the misery, and preferably less of the boring stuff in between as well. And that's something I remember constantly thinking about this as I kind of got a bit older, kind of got to my teens and a bit beyond, and I was not having a kind of spiritual bent. I thought, what to do with your life, I suppose, just enjoy yourself as much as you can. And just, don't have an unpleasant time. It's notable that most religions seem to teach the opposite, or at least not teach that, but usually the other extreme is like, you've got to have no fun at all. Any kind of fun is just, must be sinful or something. I remember I was brought up a Catholic, and I don't think the Catholics are too bad on that kind of point, actually. But you certainly get some Christian denominations and other teachings, and that seem to, like, I think it's Puritan types, that any kind of fun is bad, basically, the work of the devil. I remember, I don't know, there was a comedian called, what's his name? Dave Allen? I don't know if he was known in Australia, but in England he was very popular when I was a child, and he was a Catholic, and he talked about how this basic idea that, you know, in life, if you kind of drink and gamble and womanize and overindulge in food and all these kind of things, this is considered really bad, so you go to hell. But if you're very abstemious and give up all these things, then you go to heaven. And his reasoning was that since heaven is full of people who don't indulge in these kind of things, whereas hell is full of people who have fun, then the really good people actually go to hell, and the bad people go to heaven. Because, you know, if you've been really bad, you go to heaven where it's boring for eternity. But if you've been good for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years, then you can go to hell and enjoy yourself for the rest of eternity. And, you know, it was laughable. He was a comedian, but it's kind of, some people actually have this kind of idea that if you deny yourself in this life, that's so that you can have kind of pleasure in future life. And if your idea of pleasure is nothing beyond just, you know, food and sex and drink, then you'll have this kind of bizarre kind of idea. But of course, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, if something's bad now, then why is it good in the afterlife? So the Buddha, when he, you may know about the basic story of the Buddha, he was born into a very wealthy aristocratic family, so he had the best of everything when he was young. And he did what most people do, basically enjoyed sensual pleasures, enjoyed all the food, the music and so forth. But what he found was what people throughout history have found, as if they get the opportunity to really indulge to their heart's content, and not many people do. The Buddha was a kind of an aristocrat, a kind of prince. Nowadays, you don't have to be a prince to have loads of sensual pleasures heaped on you. Most of us, in lay life, the pleasures we've got now, the access to music, to food, you know, you have any kind of food you want from all over the world. You don't have to be wealthy. Music on demand, you walk around, you know, you don't have to have any moment of the day when you're not listening to music, really, unless you come to listen to a talk or something. You can be cycling, walking down the street, sitting at work, listen to music, fine foods, music, movies, drama, entertainment, you know, all day long. Have it really good, actually. But the advantage of this is that we have the opportunity to see that actually, in the end of the day, just having more and more of this kind of thing just doesn't satisfy. When you only have a little, then you can imagine that having more will satisfy you. So if you're very, very poor, people in Thailand and Sri Lanka, many of these people, they imagine that they, if they were reborn in America, I mean, not all of them believe this, but if they were reborn somewhere like America or Australia or something, they'd be happy, because in those countries people have all these things and all these belongings and these big houses and fast cars and things. The life would be wonderful. Or now, in our society, it's amazing the number of people who really believe that if they were rich and famous, that they would really be happy. I had a friend who was... she was an actress. I hope she didn't hear this, actually. But I remember asking her, because she obviously wanted to be famous, and I remember thinking, do you think, you know, if you were famous, then that would be it? You'd be happy then. That would make you happy, specifically being famous. And she looked at me in the eye and said, yes. Yeah. And she honestly thought, and maybe some of you think this, I don't know, but that just being famous and in itself is going to give you some kind of happiness. I don't know. Anyway, it's bizarre idea to me. But if you haven't had it, I suppose you can still imagine that it will be good. Just as a child who hasn't had, I've heard kids actually say, "Please, can I have this toy or something? If you give me this, I'll never ever ever ask for anything again." If you've heard kids say this, "I'll never ever," and they really believe it because they believe that if you give me that, that'll be it. I won't need anything else. I'll be completely satisfied. And as we get older through life, we gradually learn that, okay, having that toy doesn't completely satisfy you. In fact, you're bored of it pretty quickly. But we still believe other things will give us satisfaction, lasting satisfaction. And we get older still, and we realize, okay, those things don't. But we still kind of believe that somewhere out there are the things that will give us lasting satisfaction. At some point, many people, and the Buddha was one of these people, realize, actually, nothing, none of these things, no matter what I taste, no matter what I see, no matter what feelings I get in the body, none of this is going to give me lasting satisfaction, because it's all impermanent, it all ends. It's good for a while, but then it passes. So, yeah, there must be a different way. There must be another way to get peace and happiness in the world. This can't be the best way. And the Buddha, he realized this while still a young man. He had the wisdom to see that all of these things pass eventually. So, you know, how can you? You know, why am I following something that? Excuse me. Yeah, in the end, it's gonna pass. It's I want the highest happiness, not something which is just good for a while, not some rubbish toy that you get bored of. So he did what many people in India did and do. The examples around all around people who've renounced the world to try to seek a higher happiness. Now, in the Buddha's day, and even now to a large extent, what people tend to assume is, okay, following the sensual pleasures doesn't bring happiness, so got to give them up. And if trying to get pleasant experiences doesn't lead to ultimate happiness and realization, then having no sensual pleasures at all and denying all of these things, that must be the way. And certainly seemed that that's what people thought in the Buddha's day. There's no, although there were sort of some talks of meditation teachers and things, there are, of all the records that come down to us of different pre-Buddhist times, all of the teachings about meditation or any kind of spiritual practices, they all involve suffering and pain, basically. They all always there in all these teachings. It's taken for granted that spiritual practice is something which is painful, and they use the word tapas, which means kind of heat. So it's like turning up the heat on the practice. So spiritual practice in the Buddha's day meant torturing yourself, and so the Buddha he did this. He joined in with all these the kind of things people did at the time, eating very little. Sleeping on beds of nails and holding his breath until his brain was splitting and all sorts of bizarre and really kind of revolting practices that he did. And being a very, very special person, being for one very healthy, young, healthy and enormous determination, he was able to push himself to real extremes. Just as, because he was able to have the extremes of sensual pleasure, he was able to realize, well, it doesn't work. Because he went to the extremes of torturing himself, he was able to see, well, that doesn't work either. It's a complete waste of time. I've done as much as anyone can do. I mean, I really pushed myself to the limit, very, very close to death in punishing myself. And it's got me absolutely nowhere. I'm no closer to enlightenment now than I was when I started. And rather than just plodding on or thinking, well, I've got to try harder, he realized, no, there must be another way. There must be another way. And, you may know the story. So he had a memory of, as a child, of sitting in a kind of peaceful state of mind, entering a deep meditation that wasn't painful, that was pleasant, but it had nothing to do with sensual pleasures. And thanks to this, he was remembering that, he realized, oh, this is the middle way. This is the way between the extremes. And following this, he was able to become enlightened. So what the Buddha realized was that torturing the body doesn't work. But on the other hand, just indulging anything goes also doesn't work. So when he first taught, after his enlightenment, when he first taught to these previous companions he'd lived with, this is how he described it. He says, I've found a middle way. He says, there's one extreme is just going for indulging in sensual pleasures. That's the usual way. That's what people normally do. It doesn't work. Doesn't lead to the highest happiness. It's a coarse kind of pleasure. It doesn't get you enlightened. There's the other extreme, torturing yourself. It's not even pleasurable, and it doesn't get you enlightened. So I found the middle way. So the thing is, what is the middle way? So it's quite, probably a lot of people know that, okay, Buddhism teaches the middle. But what this actually means, you can hear lots of different opinions. So what the Buddha taught then, in that first teaching, was that the middle way is the Eightfold Path, and it gave a kind of detailed description of it. But in general terms, in terms of specifically, you know, sensual pleasures, you know, what is the right attitude? Because as you know, I mean, as you can see, the Buddha had disciples who became monks and nuns. Now, monks and nuns give up all sorts of sensual pleasures. So this can seem, to most people, well, this is pretty extreme. So you think, okay, we're not going to, no music, no sex, no movies, no drugs, no alcohol, giving up all these things. You know, is this what the Buddha said everyone should do? And you do hear that. You do hear that in Theravada, well, you read it, I've read in books, saying Theravada Buddhism teaches that that everybody has to become, you know, you should become a monk or a nun, and only monks and nuns can become enlightened. So I've read this in books on Buddhism, and, you know, this isn't, Theravada Buddhism doesn't teach that. Maybe some Theravada Buddhists teach that, but that's not what the Buddha taught, and it's not the actual, you know, it's not what's in the scriptures of Theravada Buddhism either. But it's an impression many people get. But you'll also hear that Buddhism teaches, you know, well, anything goes, basically, in Buddhism. There's no rules, anything goes. You can just go for it, you know. But then that's just the other extreme. That's the original extreme of just overindulging. What generally people kind of, you hear is that sensual pleasures, it's all right, as long as you just have a bit, but not too much. Or you have the sensual pleasures, but you don't attach to them. And so all of these things, these different kind of teachings, have got kind of an element of truth in them. What did the Buddha teach? He taught lay people. It wasn't just monks he taught. Many people came to him asking for advice. And if householders came to him, people with kids hanging off them and talking about their work, the Buddha would give them advice about how to do their work best and how to live the life, what to do with their money, how to, you know, you should save a bit of it, and the rest you should spend, you know, be generous, give to charity, but the rest spend on your family, enjoy yourself. So, the Buddha definitely taught that we don't have to be miserable. The proper use of your wealth, if you work honestly, earn a living, the proper thing to do with it is to spend it and enjoy it. That's what the Buddha said you should do with your wealth. Spend it on yourself, on your family, your friends, your employees, your employer, you know, depending. You just, people around you, make them happy with it. Somebody who earns a lot of money and then doesn't spend it is like foolish. You know, if you just hoard your wealth, this is very, you know, you're doing all that work, but then, you know, what for? So how do we square this with the idea the Buddha recommended people to give up everything, leave the home life, become celibate, because he did recommend people to do that too. I mean, you know, there are monks and nuns because the Buddha recommended people to do this. So was he giving one teaching for lay people and one teaching for monks? Was he just, you know, teaching different things at different times? Or is there a kind of, did he keep this higher teaching back for other people? Well, no, he didn't. One of the things about the Buddha's teachings, and one of the great things about it, is that it's a consistent whole. There isn't different teachings for different people, or no hidden teachings. He taught it as a path, the simile of a path. You start from where you are on the path, and you walk towards the goal, which is Nirvana. And there's no points of backtracking or having to, okay, now you've come this far, now you've got to go back and undo what you've done before. This is, the Buddha would ridicule people who taught practices where you have to do something, but then you give up what you practiced before, or you go back. It's like, two steps forward, one step back. But how come then? How come the Buddha told people, enjoy yourself, and at the same time, there are dangers in sensual pleasure? The answer, or the clue to the seeming contradiction, is what the Buddha pointed out about all sense pleasures, is that There is gratification, there is the enjoyment and the gratification that comes from sensual pleasures. And to deny it is foolish. You can enjoy yourself through the senses. But there is also, there is the drawback, the danger is the word you see in translations of the Buddha's teachings, but it means the drawback seems to be a better word. So, yeah, there are pleasures in sensuality, but there are drawbacks too. And, furthermore, there is the escape. There is something beyond. So, as for the gratification, well, yes, to deny that it's fun, enjoying yourself, is foolish. So to pretend that really, you know, all those people out there in the pub, they think they're enjoying themselves, but they're not. You know, they're having a miserable time. As I remember, someone who, an alcoholic, was saying once, you know, they think they're enjoying themselves, but they're not. You know, they are. They are enjoying themselves. They're laughing, you know, they're having a good time. And likewise, people who are enjoying good food are enjoying good food. You know, it's not the case that they're not. But, as we all know, and it's easiest to see this in the extremes, like of addictions and things, there are drawbacks. So with food, a drawback, you eat too much food, you become obese, you know, it's bad for your health. You eat too much food in one go, you throw up, you feel sick. I mean, generally, by the time you're in your 20s and things, you don't do that anymore. But children do this. I mean, you give a child enough jelly and ice cream, and most children will eat until they're sick. Now, to an adult, that seems utterly ridiculous. It's like, you can imagine yourself, I mean, some people do have eating disorders, so I suppose it does carry on into adulthood. But generally, you know, you wouldn't do that. You know, if someone offers you something you like, you think, oh, thank you. They offer you another one, you think, great, okay. Offer you a third one, you think, well, actually, yeah, it's not fun anymore, actually. I'm beginning to feel a bit sick, thanks very much, but no, yeah, that's enough. So we see that. When we're young, we learn that about food, okay? But then there's other things, silly games and so forth. You play lots of games and as a child, then as you get older, they're just not interesting anymore. So what it is that you kind of see through it, don't you? You see through the pleasure. So maybe if you've got a younger sibling, I mean, I had older brothers and sisters, and I would, my next older brother was 6 years older, so it's quite a big gap. So he would play with us when we were younger. But it got to a stage where the kind of things we wanted to play, I had a twin brother, so me and my twin brother, we'd want to play, and we'd try to drag Ian into it, but it's like, you can see the poor guy, he was bored. Yeah, his brain playing these stupid games with us, because it's like, you know, 8-year-old kids, and he's 14 years old, he doesn't want to play these silly games. But, so if you think about the things, the sensual pleasures in general, this kind of thing happens throughout our lives. So what the Buddha recommended is that you, okay, enjoy sensual pleasures, but yeah, understand them for what they are, recognize the pleasure that comes from them, but also recognize the drawbacks. So recognize that you eat too much, you get sick. Recognize that if you drink, then you get a hangover. If you drink, you get a hangover, you say stupid things, you do all these other foolish things. You maybe do things that you wouldn't ordinarily do and so forth. If you go bungee jumping and doing exciting things, go hang gliding. These are all very well. They are enjoyable. But if you try to spend all your time just doing nothing but like really extreme, exciting things, then ordinary life becomes a bit dull, basically. You know, if you get into drugs, take a lot of drugs, then when you're up, it's great. But when you're not on drugs, it's not only just not great, it's utterly miserable. You know, you've got the come down. So there's the upside and there's the downside. Now, when you see... as you get a bit older, and you see that, you know, if I eat any more ice cream, I'm going to be sick, then it's quite easy to just relinquish it and just think, well, I won't have any more. I'll just have so much, but not any more. And you don't regret it. You don't think, how sad, you know, having to get up, pigging myself on ice cream. You know? But you realise, well, it's just not fun, actually. You might, yeah, there might be a slight temptation when you look at something. You say, if I eat that, I'm going to be sick. So you don't really seriously want to do it. When you get older, when I was at university, I knew that I tended to go out and drink till I was sick and throw up. I mean, it's ridiculous to do that. It's just as foolish as eating till you throw up. And yet, time and again, I would do it. I would go out, drink, and I'd get to a level of inebriation that I found pleasant. But for some reason, I wouldn't stop there. There's something about alcohol that makes you want to keep drinking more of it. You don't think, you know, having however many pints of beer made me feel like this, and this feels very nice, so I'll just stop. You think, oh, so I'll have more, you know, and then you... Next thing you know, you wake up and you vomit on your pillow. And then you think, never again. And, you know, usually the next night you don't want to, but by 36 hours later, you're ready to do it all over again. And certainly by next week. But then as you get older, you know, you actually stop. I mean, you realize, oh, no, you know, I must be getting old. I don't enjoy going out having 15 pints anymore. And there is actually foolish, I mean, there is a bit of a twinge of regret then. Oh, no. You know. But at the same time, the reality is you don't enjoy going out and having 15 pints. And what's happened is you've wised up, basically. You've wised up. So it's not that you've, you don't need somebody, some abolitionist coming along to tell you, you know, don't drink alcohol and banning it. And you realize for yourself that it's no fun. So you give it up. So this is how we relate to the senses in the pleasures in life. If we just overindulge, then it creates lots of problems. And most people tend to realise sooner or later, and then gradually could moderate their behaviour. Some people don't, and so people become. Some people just carry on eating too much throughout their whole lives, and it kills them. Some people become drug addicts. In fact, most people become drug addicts, actually, because most people in society are addicted to at least alcohol, I think. I mean, I was, before I became a monk. Drink to excess. But gradually, we see these things, and we give them up when we're ready. So this gives a kind of clue to the attitude as a Buddhist to pleasures. Because the reason I wanted to talk about it is because people tend to go to extremes. So there's the extreme of overindulgence. But also, many people get the idea that if you become a Buddhist, you've got to kind of give off everything up. And I went through a kind of phase like this myself before I decided I wanted to become a monk, where I thought, look at the Buddha's teachings, and he said, his basic line on sensual pleasures are, there is pleasure, but it's not very much. And there is the drawback, and there's a big drawback. And there is an escape, and that's what you should aim for. So the teaching seems to be saying, you've got to give it up, really. And you can see, because the monks and the nuns, the way the Buddha lived, I think, okay, he obviously, yeah, he's wise, how did he live? Well, he didn't have much sensual pleasures. So I think, oh no, you know, have I got to just be like that? You know, I enjoy my books and my films and all this. And you meet people who've had this idea. They get into Buddhism, they get a lot of faith, but then they feel that they've really got to cut everything out. And they make themselves miserable unnecessarily. So cut everything out of life, cut all the pleasure out of life. But if you don't have something to replace it with, then basically it's no fun. So, you know, you get Buddhists like this, you get from other religions as well. People who think they've got to be... you can't have any fun in life, basically. But this isn't the way. This isn't what the Buddha is aiming to teach people. But what you do is that if you just investigate, see for yourself, okay? Well, what happens? If you, if you get legless every weekend, what happens? You know, if you overeat, what happens? If you spend all your time just trying to go out and have fun and everything, try to fill every minute of the day with entertainment. You know, what happens in the times when you can't? My nephew, he came to the monastery. I hope he doesn't hear this as well. Anyway, he came to the monastery in England, and to see me, because I was leaving to come here to Australia. And he, I thought maybe he'd be vaguely interested in learning a bit about meditation and seeing how I lived as well. But he turned up, and he arrived a little bit late for the meal, so we put some food aside for him, and he was eating this. And, like, you know, he seemed to be taking a long time eating his food, so I went to have a look to see what he was up to. And there he was. He was in the kitchen in the monastery with his earphones in and his Walkman in front of him, and he stole a full plate of food. I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "Oh, yeah, I've just been fiddling with this and taking a while." So I was like, "Oh, well, Lee, you know, no music. You can't listen to music when you're here." And he looked at me and was like, "What?" He's like, no music, sorry. Oh, no. Yeah. And I'd already told him, you know, on the phone. I said, "Oh, by the way, yeah, you know, we don't eat in the afternoon." He's like, "What?" He's like, "You don't eat in the afternoon." I said, no, we don't eat in the afternoon. If you're staying in the monastery, you don't eat in the afternoon." He said, "No, you don't eat in the afternoon." I said, no, you don't eat in the afternoon. I thought, oh, no. So then he gets there, and it's like, no music. It's like, oh, God, yeah, okay. And then goes upstairs, and he's putting his stuff away. So I said, like, "Just put it away." He says, "Okay." And I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "Oh, that's my Game Boy," or whatever it's called. I don't know what it was called. No Game Boys, no kind of games. Like, what? It's like, oh, no. I felt a bit guilty, actually, but I said, "Well, no, you could, like, you know, in the monastery, you can't have any of these things." Actually forgot what the point of that story was, actually. It's embarrassing, but... I'll probably remember about 10 minutes' time, and then I'll tell you what it was. Okay. So anyway, so the thing about... Okay, I'll go back to the idea of giving up the sensual pleasures. There was a point in that, but I'll see what it was. You know, gradually, in our own time, we give things up, okay? So it's no fun being told by someone else, "You can't do this, you can't do that." Okay, he chose to come to the monastery, so that was his, you know, he had to put up with the rules. To give everything up in one go, obviously that just doesn't work. People try it and, you know, get very unhappy. So, but as we, if we investigate, we just see what happens, what we do, then, you know, you gradually let go of things little by little, okay, if you reflect on it. But we need something to replace it with. To just give up everything, all kind of pleasure in life, is no good at all. But that's because the thing is, not all pleasures are sensual pleasures, for one thing. So not all happiness is even... has the drawbacks. There are some types of pleasure which don't have a drawback. So, for instance, the pleasure of the pleasure you get from being generous or helpful to someone. So you give someone a gift, and the pleasure you get from seeing their face light up. That's a feeling of the pleasure from renunciation. And this isn't a sensual pleasure, and it doesn't actually have its drawbacks. Okay. Being too generous can have its drawbacks. You know, you can impoverish yourself if you don't know any sense. But the actual pleasure there, the actual pleasure dependent upon the giving, isn't a negative pleasure, isn't a sensual pleasure. And it doesn't have its downside. So well, the pleasure, if you see someone else doing something good, and you think, oh, good for you, you know, and it kind of warms your heart. You know, I mean, I heard about a couple of stories of... things people had done over in Victoria to help out some of the bushfire victims. And people had done all sorts of things spontaneously. And when you read about these things, about people making sacrifices, there's kind of warm feeling. You think, oh, yeah, how nice. That's a really nice thing to do. That feeling you get, in Buddhism we call that mudita, that feeling of good, you know, good for you. That's a completely wholesome kind of feeling. And it feels good. It feels good to feel that. And it's not something you need to feel, you need to kind of cut back on. You know, or I've been feeling too good about other people lately, you know, I must cut back on that. The feeling of just genuine love for other people, just selfless love, metta, you know, loving kindness, like mother love. You can't feel too much of that. These kind of pleasures, the pleasure from just saying no, when you realize, okay, you know, when you say you know, no, I won't have that third ice cream, you know, so I'll feel sick. The pleasure you get later from thinking, good thing I didn't have that, or else I'd have felt really sick. You know? I mean, just the pleasure of giving up, or even the sense of, say, you're clearing things out, you know, even just like clearing out the, you know, you've got some job you've been meaning to do, and you've been putting it off, and you finally do it, and maybe clear up some room or something, and you look at it afterwards, and the sense of satisfaction of, clearing out the junk, and the sense of emptiness, and, you know, getting rid of the things you don't need in your house. Most people have things they don't need, you know, even in the monastery, in your hut, for a monk, you tend to accumulate bits and pieces, and every so often, well, I do anyway, every so often I kind of think, do I really need this? Do I need this? You know, and clear things out. And then afterwards, more space, more emptiness, more freedom. You know, that kind of pleasure is also, that's the pleasure of renunciation. So there are these non-sensual pleasures. And also then, of course, you know, even more profound, the pleasure from meditation. So these are the pleasures which replace the pleasures you give up in sensual pleasures. But the thing is, you do it at your own pace. You're at your own pace. Don't try to force it. So, as I said, I thought, I've got to, you know, I have to give all these things up. I suppose I should stop reading novels, stop going to the movies and all this kind of stuff. And there was a point when I got out of balance. I give things up, but I wasn't really getting much anything else for you to, you can get into a kind of depressed kind of state. This isn't right. So give things up, fine, but only when you're ready. Only when you really, when you actually look at them and think, I don't want that anymore. Just as you know, when a kid says, come and play this game or something, you think, no, you know, I'm bored of that. You know, I've had enough of that. It happens with monks in the monastery as well. You get some people, they try really hard, or novices, monks, novices, and people who come to stay, you think, right, I'm really gonna go for it. And they put, you know, loads of effort in. And, you know, okay, there is right effort. We do need to put effort into our practice. But, you know, you see, again, in the end, people gritting their teeth and really gonna go for it. You can do that for a while, but that's just willpower. And willpower only works for a while, and then, you know, you collapse. It's just like after a certain amount, you can only keep going for so long, then you collapse, and then it all goes out the window. It's like trying to give up smoking or something. If you try to give up smoking through willpower, it can work, I think, but it's very rare that it does. But if you can... I read a book on giving up smoking years ago, even though I didn't smoke. I was so impressed with it, I bought it and recommended it to people. It is a really good book, really good book. And what's more, once I learned about Buddhism, I realized it's very much in keeping with Buddhist attitudes. I don't think I was Buddhist at the time. Of course, I shouldn't advertise, but it's a very good book. And if anyone's interested, they can ask me afterwards. But the idea behind the book was, don't just try to give up what you want. If you want something really bad, and if you're looking at giving up cigarettes, like giving up this pleasure, then you're going to find it really difficult because you want it. So you try to give it up, but you want it, and you constantly battle. So the whole method was to do with getting to the state where you don't want to smoke anymore. And, you know, the whole book you led through all the reasons, all the, if you like, the dangers, like the drawbacks that the Buddha talked in Sensual Pleasures. So it does it for smoking specifically. This book just all about, this is what it does to your health. This is what it does to your bank balance. You know, these are the different ways you can die from smoking. These are all the diseases people get, and it's got pictures in it as well. This is the amount that somebody spends on it all the time. This is what it does to your general level of happiness and nerves, and all these kind of things. And till you get to the state where you think, my God, I don't want to keep doing this to myself. And in Buddhism, that's called nibbida. That's like the sense of revulsion where, you know, I don't want this. Just as the feeling you get when you wake up, as I remember doing at least once, waking up in with vomit stuck to your face on your pillow. And the thought is like, my God, you know, why the hell, you know, what am I doing? You know? And at that point, at that moment, you don't ever do it again. You know? But unfortunately, that tends to pass. But that feeling, that revulsion with what is deserved of revulsion, that can be developed. And so this, the book on smoking, that's the method of this book, is you develop that and you keep reflecting on these things. And then until you get to the stage where you really don't want to smoke. And at that point, then it says, then now give up. And it tells you to keep smoking while you're reading the book. And then at the end it says, right, now give up smoking and don't start again. And ideally, if it's worked, then you don't ever want to start again. And you're not using willpower. And it's easy. You're giving up, you know, just easy. It's as easy if someone offers me a cigarette. It's not difficult for me to say no thanks. I don't smoke. You know, it's difficult for somebody who wants to, but for somebody who doesn't smoke, it's easy to say no. Just as if, you know, if you don't drink or, you know, if someone offers you a drink, it's easy to say no if you don't want to. But if you want it, then it's difficult. So just in terms of, you know, enjoy life, in other words, you know, as lay people, you enjoy the sensual pleasures, enjoy music, movies, all these kind of things. But be aware that all of them, they do have the drawbacks, and just, you know, look out for them, just notice them. Don't feel that you should be giving things up. But if at some point you notice that, if I listen to music all the time, then all day long, you know, as much as I can, then when there isn't any music to listen to, I feel like there's something missing and I kind of get bored really easily, you know. Or if you notice, if I go to see this kind of film, one of the Anagarikas was telling me that he likes, at the monastery, he really likes, like, horror films and slasher films and things. It's like, well, I mean, if you like them, fine, watch them. But just notice, I mean, do you get nightmares? Or if you're, say, walking alone at night in the dark, do you get nervous? Because I found I used to get very nervous when I first went to the monastery, walking through the forest. Even though there's nothing really to be afraid of there, but I used to be very, very anxious. So this is in England. And sometimes it had to be like 2 a.m, I'd be walking back through this dark forest. And it'd be really frightening. I noticed after a few years, I no longer got frightened. I could walk through this forest in the middle of the night, and I was completely relaxed. And I kind of got the feeling, it's actually because of the things I've been picking on. I hadn't been watching movies, horrible movies, for 2 years. Also, I hadn't been reading awful stories of terrible things that happen all over the globe, because you can watch the news at night. I don't recommend that you cut yourself off in a cocoon and not know what's happening in the world. But you don't need to know about every brutality that happens. You don't need to read about every murder, every atrocity that's happening on the planet, because it's happening all over the planet. In times gone by, people wouldn't know about it. You know, I remember when, I think it was in Tasmania, there was someone killed, and there's some atrocity in Tasmania years ago. You probably know what it was, but in a school. You know, we heard about that in England the next morning. You can get the impression that the world is in a terrible, terrible state now because we hear about so many things happening. But in the past, if you were living in England, in Europe, you wouldn't hear about things, you know, children in the United States shooting up all their schoolmates and so forth. You might hear about it a few years later. Some story might drift across the Atlantic, you know. But nowadays, we can hear about these things all over the world. Notice, what does that do to your mind? You know, to sit there and watch the news about all these things happening. Maybe better to just could maybe get a newspaper once a week that could get, you know, lets you know roughly what's going on, you know. Just a suggestion. But, also, like with horror movies and things, maybe you get the kind of thrill from watching them. But do you find that when you try to meditate afterwards, you know, it doesn't quite get as peaceful as you would otherwise? You know? So I became a monk. I decided to go and live in the monastery because I really still enjoyed life. I enjoyed lay life. It wasn't like I could have, you know, I was unlucky in love or, you know, something terrible happened to me. I was enjoying life. But I began getting a lot of pleasure through meditation too. And I realized that I can only get so much pleasure from meditation, then I go back to do these other things, and that kind of, the meditation doesn't go any further. So if I want more of this kind of pleasure, then I've got to give up that. And, one of the, I mean, really simple but, you know, quite deep things the Buddha said, a wise person will give up a small pleasure for a greater pleasure. Now that's the kind of thing, like, again, which children, you know, they kind of find difficult to do. You know, but if you just wait, you know, you can have this now, but if you wait, you can have, you know, you have two of them, you know. And many, many children, they can't wait. Just like, I want the instant gratification. And that's what we all like to a certain extent. So I found that I could get a kind of pleasure, a kind of peace from meditation that was of completely different nature, but also far, far more satisfying through meditation. But then I also saw what meditators see is that sensual pleasures, they agitate the mind. And this is another of the many drawbacks. I mean, the Buddha enumerated all these drawbacks of sensual pleasures. Yeah, if you want to have fun and have a high life, then you've got to work to get it. You know, you've got to, you know, quite apart from getting addicted to them and all the kind of those kind of downsides, it's a lot of work. I mean, if you want all the latest gadgets and things and a fast car, you've got to work for it. And if you want to work, then you've got to, you know, generally do something you'd rather not be doing. So, you know, and then maybe you get sacked anyway. You know, you build up, you know, you work for years, save up for something, and then, you know, the house prices all drop and all these kind of things. These are all drawbacks. This is the problem. If you're seeking your happiness in life through the things outside of you, through objects and things, then this will happen. So it's not that you just like, you should give it all up. Just be aware of this. Think about it. If you find that you can get pleasure in other ways, then maybe you just start cutting back. You know, so that's first what I started to do. For me, it was just a gradual thing, you know. But then I tried going too far. I tried to cut it before I was a monk, you know, before I decided to become a monk. I tried cutting out too many things. But because I hadn't really got anywhere in my meditation, there was nothing left for me, really. It was all kind of dull and boring. And the inspiration had kind of faded a bit in a couple of years, the inspiration in Buddhism that made me want to do this. It was kind of, it was all right, but it all seemed a bit flat and empty. But then luckily for me, you know, my meditation started coming together, and that made me see, okay, there's a clear choice here. And in my particular case, I decided, actually, because at the time I didn't have a girlfriend, didn't have a great career, I'd never been that much into gadgets and having all these things and holidays and stuff anyway. So for me, it was an easy decision to actually completely give it all up. But for other people, they just find, okay, you get pleasures from doing good for others, or from meditation, or from these more wholesome things. So then you can just gradually cut back on the other things. Just cut out. You know, when you see that things are just leading to your own suffering, then just cut them out. So this is the kind of the attitude. So this is, I still haven't remembered why I mentioned, when I listen to the tape of this, I'll be able to maybe figure out why I mentioned my nephew. But so anyway, in sum, what I basically wanted to point to is that what does Buddhism say about sensual pleasures? That yes, it does, the Buddha did teach that that really in the long run, they only give a certain amount of pleasure, a little bit of pleasure, but the amount of drawbacks is far greater. That's not something to just take on faith and just believe. It's something to investigate. The Buddha said you should know the gratification, understand it for what it is. You should know the drawbacks, understand them for what they are, and see the way to lessen the drawbacks, the way out, the escape, which is more relinquishing. But you have to actually see it. To just give things up just on faith isn't going to work. But it is, I haven't talked so much about the drawbacks. I'm kind of assuming that people kind of see what they are, but you know, this is the things to investigate. The enormous amount of work it takes just to get, yeah, to have a good time. I mean, even just the holidays, to arrange a holiday. The amount of work you have to put in to arranging a holiday. And it only has to go a bit wrong, and it's all a waste of time. Yeah, it's sort of like it just rains the whole. I mean, England, that was a thing. We'd go to the beach every year. We used to go to the beach, and one year it just rained for an entire week. It's just unfortunate that week it rained. Utterly boring week, and we'd had much more fun just back at home. Yeah, it's just utterly boring, stuck in a caravan, arguing with each other. Yeah, you know, kind of bickering, grumpy, awful kind of thing. It's like, and all the work, you know, my poor old mum, all the work she used to put into to trying to make holidays fun for the kids. She obviously never had, as I got older, I realised, mum never had any fun on holiday at all. I mean, it was miserable for her. She did it for us, for the kids. So that the kids will expect a holiday. So we used to go to the beach, and she didn't have a very good time at all. All that work, you know. just to arrange a night out can be a lot of work, you know, kind of phoning around and phoning people back and all this kind of stuff. But we tend not to notice this. We tend to kind of discount this out of the fun we're having. But to, you know, just to see this, to see the, you know, not just when it goes wrong, all the work that goes into it, all the work you have to do. When you go to work, if you have a job you don't like, that's, you know, that's part of the drawbacks of enjoying yourself, because the only reason you're doing that job is so you can have things, so you can enjoy yourself. You know, if you didn't want to, I mean, if you were happy to live in a monastery, you wouldn't have to work. Or if you were happy to just go without anything, then you'd have to work very, very little. But it doesn't work. It doesn't work that way. So all of these things are all the drawbacks. So reflect on them. This is the thing. This is, we're not, you know, not to make ourselves miserable, not to feel we've got to give everything up. You can, you know, enjoy life, but just all the time, just have a reflective attitude to your life. And when you see that, you know, this thing, it really isn't worth it, then to just have the nerve, really, have the guts to pack it in, basically. Okay, I think I've said enough about that. I've talked for quite a while. So if anyone's got any questions or disagrees with me, especially if you disagree with me, please speak up and, yes?
You should go out and party, or?
The thing is, you need discernment. The thing is about all of this is that you need, you know, the wisdom aspect, the discernment. You've just got to see for yourself, really. What I'm saying is that, it could be, it does happen that people just they go too far, and they try to cut all the kind of, like, frivolity out of their lives, and you know, they're miserable because they haven't got, you know, there's nothing else. You need happiness in life, even as a monk. I mean, the Buddha said, you know, if you don't get some kind of happiness, you can't live this life. But the happiness for a monk is the ideal. We're supposed to have completely decided, okay, I'm giving up all sensual pleasures. I mean, you know, the reality is not quite that, you know, like that, but ideally that's it, you give it all, but only because you can get some very great pleasure from meditation. In lay life, the idea isn't to give it all up, but, you know, if you find you're giving things up and you've got nothing left, you know, just life seems kind of meaningless and pointless, then you need to find some kind of, you know, you've got to find the something in life. And if that means maybe you just go out a bit more once in a while, or just socialize a bit more, whatever it is you need to do, then, you know, you've got to do something. But if you find for a long time you're living in a kind of way that you're just miserable, then you've just got to, just as the Buddha realized, you've got to think, this isn't working. There's got to be a different way. I've got to somehow balance. But usually, you know, if you just watch and don't try to necessarily work it out with your head, you, eventually something will just click. You'll sort of get a feeling, I should do this or I should do that. You know. But that's wisdom, basically. You've just got to allow it to come up. I'm not saying you go out and live it up and party and go to the other extreme. But just, you know, just warning that you can try too hard, basically. Yeah, so really, basically, I mean, short answer. I'm not very good at giving short answers. The short answer is you've got to see for yourself, basically. Yeah. That's probably put anyone else off of asking a question now. So, any questions? If not... Okay. Yes? Yeah. Can you remember what I was saying just before I said that? Sorry? Yeah, yeah, but what did I say before I said he came to see me? Because that's why I was saying it. Okay, well, never mind. I'll work it out.
Maybe it was to see you, what your life you have, but he couldn't understand why it was.
No, that, I can't. It's gone, I'm afraid. It's gone. It's lack of mindfulness. Okay, so thank you for listening. I hope it's been useful.